I'm Rob. I know you're out there. I know it's going to be a shock to you, but I'm attempting for the first time to graduate and give a talk without slides. So bear with me. I'm not quite sure how this is going to go. Quick story. We have a lot of so I'm going to tell stories today and kind of give you some perspective on all this. Quick story. And this was really apropos to have me here on the 10-year anniversary of the whole mad cow thing. And it brought me back to telling stories about that, especially when I was home here over the weekend, drove down to help pick out replacement heifers in our operation down there. It was after Christmas 10 years ago that my sister called me. And I'll never forget this. Christmas morning, her kids usually, your kids usually run into the bedroom and say, "Mommy, Daddy, Mommy, Daddy, you know, Santa Claus was here. Look what's under the tree." And then that year, my sister's kids ran into the bedroom, she said, and they said, "Mommy, Daddy, Mommy, Daddy, Uncle Greg's on CNN." And that was a really scary time for our industry, and glad we lived through it. But today we're kind of going to talk about trade, and Roger, good job on the Washington stuff. I spent the last 2 years, until May, I spent the last 2 years working on the Senate Ag Committee for Senator Roberts. I was involved in writing the trade and livestock and miscellaneous provisions of the 2012 Senate Farm Bill. We actually wrote, it wasn't previous to my time at the Cattlemen, it's since the Cattlemen. We actually wrote the Farm Bill three different times in that process in the last 2 years, and we still haven't passed the thing. So, when you were making light of many of those issues and so many of the things you had up there, Roger, the things that I've been working on the last 2 years, for me, it's not easy to take those things lightly. It's very, very serious, and those are extremely difficult issues. And when you're a Senate Ag Committee staffer, your boss, the senator, his expectation is, Greg, it's your job to handle these, and I better not hear about it. You better do a good job, and so it's a really interesting and frightening process. But today we're going to talk about cattle and cattle trade, and today I want to talk to you as just a fellow cattleman, not as a guy from Washington D.C. And that's I'm involved in a cow calf operation back in Kansas. Key things I want to share with you today are militant about a 60-day calving window. We do a good job picking out replacement heifers. My partner's a veterinarian. Nutrition, nutrition, nutrition. We work on it constantly. Work really hard with nutritionists to work on that ration and get it right with those cows. We don't use a bale of alfalfa. We use CRP, prairie hay, brome, whatever we can get our hands on, straw, and distillers. And in our country, we can use modified distillers. It works really, really well. We background everything to about 750, 800 pounds. Our March calves will go to market here in about 10 days, and they'll go through the sale barn directly to a feed yard somewhere. But I will tell you, in the post-commodity boom cycle environment, and I think the punchline today is for the grains, I think the commodity cycle is peaked and is headed the other direction. But I think we've got a few good years left here on the beef side, and I think actually they could be really, really good for a long time. So there's some opportunity here, and that opportunity really comes from the trade side of the equation. When I first started in this thing, there was, as he described, there's a huge debate over this trade issue and NAFTA and everything else, but I think we've kind of gotten over that, and we realize that the new money in our industry is coming from the trade side of the equation. As you can look through the paper, and we give you a lot of examples of all of that, but I think what I want to emphasize to you today is, at least today, and it's going to be more in the future, 17% of the money that comes to pay for the cattle that I'm going to sell and the cattle that you're going to sell comes in the form of yen, won, yuan, euros, rubles, Canadian dollars, or Taiwan dollars, or some other currency. Our customers are global. And we have to begin to think in terms of the fact that our product is going to go, that heifer that you're going to retain, she's going to have calves, and that meat is going to go 70 or 80 different countries around the world. And it has been remarkable to me since I went to work in Washington 20-some years ago and started traveling internationally. Since then, I've traveled in 40 countries. most of them several times. And over the years, it's been neat to come back to those countries time and time again. For example, Taiwan, I was there in 1994, and then I was there last spring again to see the incredible growth in these economies around the world, and the fact that, and we're going to talk about China a lot here today, the fact that once upon a time they couldn't afford our product, and now they can. And what they have the potential to do as a result of that for us and our industry, I think, is going to change everything forever. So don't get hung up. You know, a lot of the slides you'll see is on declining per capita consumption in the U.S. Don't get too hung up on that. Begin to realize that there are a lot of opportunities outside the U.S. to do this. I, in the last 10 years, Roger, have learned more about Japan and Japanese politics and how things work over there than I ever wanted to know. It has been a remarkable process to finally get that market reopened to 30 months. You know, we all went through the Agent Source era here the last few years and A40, and, you know, I don't know that I want to go through the whole story today of why we ended up on A40 and the 21 and 23-month-old dairy cows or cows they had in Japan that they claimed were BSE for years and we knew was nonsense, and we argued about it, and finally, you know, their politicians once... That's the problem in the world today in so many places around the world. Once the politician speaks and says something, he can't take it back. Well, then you're stuck. And you can't get yourself out of that process to move process forward and reopen and do get markets back to where they need to be again. What you're going to see towards the end of my presentation is part of the problem is we're our own worst enemy when it comes to that. We do that too, and it kills us. But the great thing about Japan going forward is the opportunity we have with the TPP, which is the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And I actually want... So many times you hear Roger and myself and all of us talk about, we talk about TPP and then we move right on, and most of you are, what the hell was that? What is he talking about? So I wanted to take a minute a little bit today to explain how that is and what that works. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, think of it as a wagon wheel. And so we have already free trade agreements with Chile and with Mexico and Canada and South Korea. And different countries along the Pacific Rim, both in the Western Hemisphere and in Asia. So they have that relationship with us in terms of trade. What TPP is now take the wagon wheel and draw lines to every country and connect them all. So it's a hub-and-spoke mechanism where everybody is going to enjoy the same relationships in terms of trade that we negotiated bilaterally with all of these countries. What it really is building a little bit of a base camp versus China and countries hooking their wagon to our way of doing things in terms of sanitary and phytosanitary issues, et cetera, versus the Europeans or versus the Chinese that are very European-centric. That's a very, very good and important thing for us. And I have to admit, when we first started this discussion years ago, and I've always had... security clearance where you could have conversations with our negotiators and do that in a pretty frank manner. And when I was on Capitol Hill doing that, those discussions became pretty remarkable when you go to that side of the fence. You have a real ability to kind of influence and have input on it. I didn't think it was really the right thing to do or work or spend a lot of time on it. I said, unless Japan decides to join the party. And lo and behold, they have. And now this is a really big deal because what this is really a backdoor free trade agreement with the Japanese. And that's a huge deal for us in beef because that tariff is 38.5%. It's one of the biggest tariffs now we face in the world and with one of our biggest customers. So the ability to get that tariff to zero over time is an enormous thing for us in this industry. Here's the punchline that you need to know today is this thing changed dramatically when the tidal wave in Fukushima happened with Japan. I assume all of you understand what I'm talking about with their nuclear reactor. Japan has made a decision they're going away from nuclear and they want to go towards natural gas. And in today's new environment, guess who has the natural gas? Shockingly, it's the United States. And so the news piece I want to share with you today is I'm actually really optimistic that we can get something done. What's the deal in TPP? natural gas for beef. They want our natural gas. And in, by the way, when we do trade agreements, that's one of the issues that was always negotiated to have access on natural gas. And we did that all the way back with the Canadian deal in 1988. Why? Because we were the importer then. And we wanted that access, and we insisted on that, and we've done that in every agreement we've ever done. Now it comes full circle back the other way. It's an interesting discussion. And if you watch what's happening in the Japanese press and the politics with their prime minister, they've recently announced agriculture in Japan. We're gonna pull the plug on some of the biggest subsidies in the world that you've had since World War II. We're going to begin to work that off and work it the other way. They've made an enormous decision here. I think this is actually going to happen, and I'm really, really excited for it. I think it opens up an enormous opportunity. Moving forward, one of the things I want to kind of emphasize today is by the time you do a trade agreement, and we do TPP with Japan, which we'll do in the next year, two or three, and you're right, Trade Promotion Authority has got to get done here. It's going to take a while. It actually takes then another 3 to 5 years for you to really feel it. And so now, in next year, after all of the things that we've done in South Korea and in the FTA, and you remember years ago they were rioting in the streets, and I still kept that New York Times front page when all that was happening, one of my mementos from my years. Next year is when it really kicks in for us in South Korea. Because that tariff was 40%. And what you do in a trade negotiation is you have to get that tariff to zero. All you're negotiating is how long it takes to get there. So it's 2.67% a year. The argument was over they wanted to do all the reduction at the end, and I absolutely not. You have to do it in equal installments. It was a huge fight. But the key is, in Korea, that is the one place on the planet where the Australians and the Americans go head-to-head on beef. And the fact now that next year we'll have about an 8% drop on the Australians in Korea is enormous. It means, and if you've seen in the article, the Meat and Livestock Australia, which is the U.S. Meat Export Federation for Australia, sounds like they're going to close their office in Korea after they spent millions in there when we were locked out due to BSE. Next year, it pretty much could mean game over for the Australians in Korea due to this free trade agreement. It is a really, really big deal, but it's taken us years to get to that point. And so the point is, these things take time, and you got to keep moving to get it done. Why am I so frustrated about some of these trade issues in Washington? And I think the summary of it goes back to one thing that I heard a long time ago when there was an interview of Mr. Sweeney, who at the time was the president of the AFL-CIO. He was asked at that time, and it was years ago, if you were in charge for a day, what's the one thing that you would do? And you know what he said? He said, I would abolish all free trade agreements. I'll never forget that, how an enormously short-sighted and appalling opinion that was. And the problem is, with the administration that we have now, and I'm going to be very blunt and frank, I don't work in the government anymore, we have a party that's pretty beholden to that way of thinking. And now when we talk about TPA, Roger, what really concerns me is you've got the far left that have always had that mentality. Now you've got some of these Tea Party folks on the far right coming out with that kind of mentality. For agriculture folks, that's a death knell. That is a death sentence if we can't continue to open these markets and move these things, because that's where the new money comes for us. And we can't afford to have that kind of mindset in Washington. It is just dangerous. And it scares me to death. Why? Well, look through the paper and see what I talk about in China. But I want to tell you the great story about China comes from a conversation I had about 5 years ago when I was sitting in the headquarters of JBS talking to Mark Gustafson, who's their head international trade guy, and his boss, who is the head of overall meat trade for JBS. And he's the son of an Australian diplomat, had just returned from China, and he said, Greg, I'll never forget. He said, Greg, you know what I saw when I was in China this time versus the previous time I was there? He said, on the table at the restaurant, there was a little pat of butter. He said, you know how much butter it takes to put a little pat of butter on every table in every restaurant in China? Think about it. Think about it. Put it in this perspective. If you're one in a million in China, there are 1,300 people just like you. It's staggering. And if you look at that chart that's in the paper, and you go down through these the bullet points, and I won't go down through them here. I'm going to talk about one thing, though. This is the craziest thing that I have ever seen, and I wasn't aware of it myself until Brett Stewart from Cattle Facts and a good friend of mine, we've been doing this together for a long time. This thing in China on beef is a game changer. And the reason it's a game changer is really one statistic that I've underlined in that paper, and I'm going to talk about here in a minute. Back when we first started doing this 10 years ago, the price that the Chinese could afford was plus or minus $2 a pound. And what could I remember distinctly giving speeches 10 years ago talking about China buying all our rectums for $1 a pound and how big a deal that was. Because when you got a packing plant, what keeps the lights on? All of the sales of all of that, all of the hearts, livers, tongues, mountain chain tripe, all of that stuff is what runs a packing plant. The dollars you can generate off of that is what greases this industry. And the fact now that not only can the Chinese afford to buy all of that stuff, but that price now in China is $4.80 a pound versus about $4.95 or $5 in the U.S. It's very simple, folks. What that tells me in terms of cattle prices going forward is we have a rock-solid floor under this thing at somewhere, I don't know, $115, $120 when you look at this cutout. And look, if we may not be able to grow this cutout domestically. We may not be able to move this thing, you know, in the short term much above where it is now. But there is an enormous, hard, solid floor underneath us, in my opinion. And that's the incentive to grow your herd, to retain those heifers, and begin to think longer term about your industry and about what you're doing. And that's why you're here today. This, in China, 10 years ago, we were talking about whether they would import 15 or 20 million tons of soybeans. This year, they're going to import 69 million tons of soybeans. It's a curve that goes like this when they begin to do this. And that's the curve that we all think we kind of, just like on that chart, we all kind of think we see with China going forward. It's kind of the tip of the iceberg, potentially. And when you're going through Hong Kong, you've got duty-free access. And that really, really works. I don't know how much more time I have here, but I want to talk about the politics of this a little bit and talk a little bit about a staff delegation trip I took when I was on the Hill to Taiwan and was part of a group that spent a lot of time. I had military folks on the trip. We had a lot of different folks on the trip. My job was to talk to everybody about ractopamine, Optiflex, at the request of the Taiwanese government. How many of you can explain to your neighbor how Optiflex works or what it is? You better get on it, folks. You have to know how to do that from my perspective and where I sit in Washington, D.C. When I go to a dinner party in Washington, you know where I end up? I end up pinned against the corner of the kitchen with these drug rep college-educated housewives that are smart as hell saying, how does this work? How does this work? What about this? What about this? What about this? Where does this come from? Because they read all this nonsense in these women's magazines, and they know it's not right, but they don't know what the right answer is. You all, and all of us in this room, have to be able to talk and be articulate about how we do what we do. If we want to use that technology in the future. This is just the tip of the iceberg, folks. The folks that are against GMOs and against all of this other stuff, they are smart, they are well-funded, they are globally connected. And why do they do it? Because they make a ton of money doing it. It is all about the money to them. They wouldn't argue over these issues or do these referendums in Washington on GMOs if they didn't make a killing doing it. People donate all the time on this. So going forward, I want you to have an image of explaining an image. One of the great images I've seen in all of my travels was in a wet market in Mexico. And it was really amazing because there was a young couple with a six-month-old baby at the wet market. Now, if you've ever understand where the wet market is, at a wet market in Mexico, the beef has to be fresh. The meat has to be fresh. So they had all these coolers, and all the meat was setting up on top of them. Because frozen beef to them, but it's changing dramatically. It was not considered fresh versus the stuff that was at room temperature. And to see that butcher with a big old knife like this take that liver and very thinly slice it, almost you could read a newspaper through it, and give a baker's dozen, 12, and then the 13th slice, flick it over, she sets the 10 pesos on there, nod their head, wrap it up, and go home for supper. How do you explain what we do to them? Because they're the next folks all around the world that are going to begin to ask these questions about how we do what we do here. And you've got to be able to be articulate about that and move forward. We've got enormous issues that we're going to continue to deal with in Washington. Two postulates, the Greg Dowd postulates of trade policy. Number one, we're our own worst enemy. First time I ever went to Mexico, I sat down with a Georgetown trade lawyer. We went through the whole discussion. As we walked out of room, he put his arm around me and said, Greg, just remember this. Everything we learned on how to jam you guys, we learned from you guys. Who's he now? He's the head lawyer for the Mexican ranchers on Cool. Good friend of mine, really sharp guy. The other thing is this whole issue about science and technology and the profit of scaring people on our food. You have to understand how all that works and deal with that. What's the final point here? The commodity cycle has turned, in my opinion, for the grains, but it's going to be good for beef. And one final point, I have notes here on the taper. The Fed is going to taper, probably not till 2014, 2015, 2016, but that scares the dickens out of me for agriculture. Because when they begin to pull in that liquidity, it means higher interest rates and a higher dollar. That is a double whammy for us in agriculture, and that is a really, really serious problem going forward for us. Okay, I'm going to quit there. We'll talk about things later.